You are listening to On Human Rights, where we bring you interviews of experts from around the world. We highlight the latest and most interesting trends and bring you information on human rights and international humanitarian law. My name is Zoe Savivu, and we're broadcasting from Raoul Wallenberg Institute in Lund, Sweden. Today with us we have Vishal Prasad, the campaign director of the Pacific Islands Students Fighting Climate Change, a youth-led organization campaigning for an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on climate change and human rights. As part of the ICJ advisory opinion campaign, he has a strong focus on securing the Pacific youth demands on the protection of the rights of current and future generations from the adverse effects of climate change. But I believe it's better if we hear more from him directly. Hello, Vishal.
Hi.
And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name is Vishal Prasad. I am from Fiji. I live in Suva, the capital. And I am currently the campaign director of the Pacific Island Students Fighting Climate Change. And we are a youth-led organization that is working on taking climate change to the highest court, the world's highest court, which is the International Court of Justice. I've been working on this campaign since 2020, and this has been something that's been of great interest to us, and I'm glad to be sharing this with you today.
Thank you so much for joining us. Could you tell us a little bit about the inception and the evolution of the Pacific Island Students Fighting for Climate Change? What motivated you to become?
So the idea for an ICJ advisory opinion, this idea began in a classroom at the University of the South Pacific. So that's a regional university here in the Pacific. And it was in their Vanuatu campus, the Emulus campus. And it was in an international environment law class where a group of students were tasked coming up with ideas of how international law could help address the climate crisis. And one of the solutions, one of the ideas that came up, the most ambitious one, was why don't we seek an ICJ advisory opinion? This is the world's highest court. They issue advisory opinions. It's great. Would you consider clarity, and it will be transformational for the world in terms of setting the path ahead? And so that was when the idea was born. And there was a group of 27 students who then began writing letters to Pacific leaders and saying such an initiative and take this forward, because to get an advisory opinion, you need the UN General Assembly to vote in favor. Only then the ICJ can consider an opinion. So that meant a country had to lead this. And at that time, it was the government of Vanuatu, which responded very favorably. And they were one of the first to say, OK, we'll consider this, we'll take this on. And that was a big achievement for the campaign to have a sponsoring country come behind the idea. And then since 2019, we have been working on taking this to the UN General Assembly. There is an journey aspect to it, which I can talk about, but I think it's also important to understand why this idea came about and what really motivated it. So beyond the assignment question, I think this idea of why selecting the ICJ as the option was because of two things. One, and we often discuss this, is that the impacts of climate change in the Pacific are becoming far more severe, far more intense and frequent than they have been in the past. We're seeing far more frequent and intense cyclones and hurricanes, floods, uncertain weather, really, sea level rise, ocean acidification, and it's affecting things, and it has ripple effects on things like food security, water, sanitation, and really just affecting quality of life. And so we often talk about all of these things, but we then miss often the discussion does not go forward to talk about the human rights aspect of climate change, how climate change is impacting the human rights of people. So I mentioned food and water security. That is one clear example of a human right that is being threatened when climate change or the impacts of climate change are upon us. And so this campaign was about trying to put people at the center and trying to address the human rights implications of climate change, which was currently not very common in the normal discourse. And as I said, putting people at the center. But it was also about realizing that we're not moving as quickly as we need to be. We're seeing cyclone, we're seeing these intense impact already. We've got the most dire predictions from scientists, from the UN, from all agencies and organizations. But we just seem to not be moving as quickly, as effectively as we need to be. And so this was an attempt to essentially be a catalyst in existing processes, to give a jolt to say, hey, we need to wake up and we need to act and really provide the necessary ammunition to help drive action. And so from that space, I think this initiative came about.
Thank you for not only explaining it the way you did, but also for actually doing the work, because it's no joke.
Welcome, you're most welcome.
Yes, it's no joke. Could you please then, talking about how it came through and how it came to be, could you update us a little bit on the current status of the advisory opinion campaign?
So after the government of Vanuatu took this campaign on and we knew it would go to the General Assembly, we knew we needed a majority vote. So that meant 97 countries needed to support this resolution if it was to see success and if it was to get referred to the ICJ. And so we started working together, support from countries. And so we first did this with our Pacific regional countries, so those in the Pacific, at the Pacific Islands Forum in 2022. All Pacific Island leaders, 18 of them, supported the initiative. And after this regional support, it became not just a Vanuatu-led, but a Pacific-led campaign, which then moved to the international space, where in the United Nations, the team Vanuatu, along with a core group of countries, they started to gather support, galvanize UN member states to get the support. We have been working on this as well in terms of trying to build advocacy around the campaign, support the diplomatic efforts in events, in the media, with our own outreach and engagements as well. And what happened was in March of last year, historically, the UN General Assembly resolution was adopted. It did not go to a vote. We thought it would be a vote because we anticipated resistance at this from the get-go. Like we thought there certainly would be countries who will not vote yes. But it was amazing. And to our surprise, really, it was adopted by consensus. So there was no opposition. The first advisory opinion request ever to go through by consensus, enjoying huge support. 132 countries co-sponsored the resolution to the ICJ. And so this was a huge achievement for us, a huge milestone in what we call phase one of the campaign. And then after that adoption, the matter was referred to the ICJ, which is now the beginning of phase two, which is the part we're in right now. And the ICJ accepted the request and issued timelines for how the following proceedings will take place. And so it's currently been divided into two timelines, or two rounds of submissions. The first is the written submissions, which are due on the 22nd of March this year. So the written submissions, all countries and accepted international organizations, those organizations that have made requests, have been invited to make submissions on the legal question that's been asked. The legal question is the heart of this whole initiative, and that is what we want clarity on. So countries have been invited to provide their opinions, their submissions, their statements by the 22nd of March. After the 22nd of March, countries that have made a submission have until June 24 to provide comments on what other countries have said, what other country submissions have. So it's a comment stage, comment and feedback stage to what other countries have said. And we anticipate that after this, the court will open the proceedings for oral hearings, where countries will have the chance to present orally their arguments. We don't have confirmation from the court yet, and it's likely they will announce this later on along with the date. So that's where we are in terms of the formal processes. And our efforts currently are focused around Really trying to get the most robust, ambitious, strong arguments before the court in the 22nd January deadline, because these arguments will shape how the opinion comes out, and we need to ensure that we seize this opportunity and we advance the most progressive and ambitious submissions to the court.
Sounds like a very intense task. If I may ask, how would the legal questions or clarifications look like?
So the legal question that the ICJ has been asked to consider, that was the legal question that was part of the UN resolution that was adopted. And if I can simplify the question, it's a two-part question. The first question is asking, what are the obligations of countries under international law to protect the climate system from anthropogenic emissions of greenhouse gases? So basically protecting the planet and the climate system. And it's asking, what are the obligations under international law generally? And this is a very different approach to how we've been working, how climate action and climate response has been guided on. So the resolution identifies a chapeau paragraph just before this question, and it lists down about 10 sources of international law. And it includes things like the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, etc. And so it makes, along with the Paris Agreement and some agreed international environment law principles like the duty of due diligence, the prevention of the marine environment, prevention of the environment, etc. So it mentions a lot of these principles as well. And so this was an attempt, really. We're trying to ask the ICJ to clarify state obligations, not just under the Paris Agreement. So currently, climate action has been guided by the Paris Agreement, and that's been good. We've made progress, but it's not enough. There are certainly gaps in the Paris Agreement. There's certainly ways that the agreement can be strengthened. And so this is an attempt to look at country obligations. What should countries do at a minimum under all of international law? So international human rights law then comes into play here. We talked about the human rights implications, and really putting people at the center of this. This is the main way we're trying to do this, by trying to get human rights law to bear on climate action or climate responses, because that has not been the case. Human rights has often been relegated as a secondary thing, or often not a factor. So by asking the court to clarify the obligations under all of international law, we are going for a very ambitious understanding of what countries should do at minimum. Because under Paris, we know it's a very limited scope. There is a limit there. But if we expand the base of how we look at and what country action should be measured against, we have a chance of really pushing the boundaries here, really pushing for transformational action, because we're then looking at a wide source of international law to guide state conduct. That's the first question. So understanding the ICJ has been asked to clarify obligations under all of international law. The second question is, what are the consequences for a failure to meet these obligations, essentially? So what happens if a country does not meet these obligations? And it then goes on to identify two subcategories of people, essentially, or groups. The first is small island developing states, by their special nature of how specifically they've been affected by the climate crisis. This is about understanding what consequences apply to these people. And the second question about peoples of present and future generations. So I mentioned the heartbeat of this whole initiative was human rights, but the second aspect was this idea of future generations, that we want intergenerational equity, that this is about ensuring that we're protecting the rights of present and future generations as well. So when we talk about the legal consequences, we're then talking about things like, what should countries do if they do not meet these obligations? So then discussions like compensation come in, discussions around loss and damage come in, about reparations, and all of these things that have been part of the climate justice movement, essentially. Because then question two becomes this climate justice question, because we're now asking, okay, there's been an inequality in the system. Countries that contributed the least, small island developing states and many others, are facing the most dire consequences of climate change. And that's a wholly unjust equation. And so now with this question, we're aiming to seek greater climate justice by asking the court to clarify this for us and talk about the consequences of specifically those that are on the receiving end of the impacts of climate change. So, and that for us is really the heart, the substance of the ICJ advisory opinion request that's going to set it apart, that's going to make it transformational, because that is the climate justice question.
Thank you so much. It really does make sense when you break it down this way. And I was just thinking, apart from this task being massive as it is, were there any challenges at any stage where you thought, wait, this is quite significant?
Yeah, this has been a long journey. We began in 2019. I joined a bit later, but and then we finally got the resolution in 2023. So it's about 4 years, more than 4 years now. There have been a lot of some significant challenges, maybe the main ones I could talk about. So this idea, as I mentioned, came out by students, was a student-led idea by young people, really no experience in the campaigning space, never dealt with the UN or the ICJ. So you can imagine how this would have been. And so I guess one of the challenges has been to get confidence within ourselves that we can do this. And right at off the bat, when we were starting in 2020, we had the global pandemic hit, and 2020, 2021, it was all lockdowns. You couldn't travel, and a lot of things were hit. And so we had, and then the campaign also took a hit because we had a timeline of what we wanted to do, where we anticipated the resolution to go through, et cetera. And all of that was derailed by the pandemic. And so we couldn't campaign, we couldn't travel to other parts, we couldn't get this support that we needed. And so that became a significant moment for the campaign, because then we had to really look into, okay, what are the chances of success? Because this was an idea that, because of the pandemic, could have just died, because everyone was now focusing on the health emergency that was out there. And so we started working with partners, young people from around the world, really, because we couldn't travel and campaign. We thought, okay, we've got colleagues there, we've got young people who are equally interested in this idea in other parts of the world. They can do the campaigning work, they can work on this initiative in their countries. And so that's when we, as a collective, we formed the World Youth for Climate Justice, which was this umbrella network that brings together young people from all other parts of the world to campaign for this. And they've been working on this alongside us since 2020. And then I think after COVID, one of the other challenge that we had was really trying to ensure that discussion on human rights and future generations is part of the legal question, because there was some opposition to this idea about, do we really need to talk about this? Because that was the heart of the whole movement. And so ensuring that we constantly talk about it in the media and any space we get, putting pressure on our leaders to ensure that this remains at the center of the question, I think that was one of the challenges. And then alongside, we had, of course, the general issues that often young people face when you get into these spaces. There's challenges around, maybe some of them do follow or get embroiled into youth tokenism, really trying to ensure, okay, is your voice really heard when you are talking about this? And they have been these overarching ones, but it's a very unique campaign and a model that worked, because here you have a civil society organization that is working alongside a government campaign that's going into the formal processes. So we're working in tandem, essentially, as a complement to the government's campaign. And while we're working on this, we've got this alliance of civil society organizations. And that happened in March of 2022, when 1,500 global civil society organizations from Amnesty, Greenpeace, CAN, Climate Action Network, Oxfam, etc., came on board and said, okay, we're going to help. We want to help take this campaign forward. And then they all started joining us and then supporting this campaign to get it through to the General Assembly, and the alliance is still active today. And so this unique model of working together with government, with other partners, meant that even if challenges did arise, we had an army of support essentially with us, with our colleagues, with our partners who were able to help take it forward with us, help support, help guide, and to ensure that we moved ahead.
Extremely positive, I would say. And it kind of keeps you going, I suppose.
Absolutely. The support we've seen has been phenomenal. I think when right down from the region, from governments like Pacific governments have been extremely supportive of this initiative. And they have also been very welcoming of the young people to come on board. And it's not a closed door kind of campaign. Even right now, civil society has been invited by governments in the region and around the world as well to draw inputs in the country submissions and help support country submissions become the best they can. So we're working on things like gathering evidence that helps the legal arguments that countries are making. So it's been a very open process, I would say. And then when we look towards our friends or colleagues and partners in the civil society space, both regionally and globally, the support has just been overwhelming. And just the climate justice movement, I think, has been so instrumental in helping open doors for us, providing opportunities. Hey, youth, I think that you need to speak at this event because these group of people need to hear what you're saying, or this campaign needs to be highlighted here. And just this coming together of the movement, coming together of people concerned about fighting climate change, really, to help support, help build this campaign by young people from the Pacific.
Sounds amazing. I have been following quite closely. So, because we're talking about equity, intergenerational equity, and I can't really think of climate change without climate justice. Would you mind sharing a little bit your thoughts or your opinion on this, in the sense of the way we think about climate change is not just about the environment? But climate justice is actually what we need.
No, absolutely. I certainly agree with that statement. And I think there definitely seems to be a disconnect in how we are responding to climate change, because we are oftentimes very focused on the physical, the scientific aspects of climate change. And these are very important, and we're not downplaying any of the impacts. But I think the underlying socio-economic repercussions of climate change have been that a lot of people have been suffering. They have been suffering when we started putting coal, we started putting carbon in the atmosphere. And this has been a generational matter. People have lost lives, people have been living in extremely devastating situations and scenarios because of this. They've had to leave homes. I've witnessed villages in the Pacific where they've had to leave their entire communities and where they've been born, where they have raised their children up. And so this is really a question about looking at what people have had to endure as a result of the actions of certain people, certain countries, and how they have not been brought to account. So accountability is something that's been missing. And I think by asking the ICJ that question about consequences, we're trying to build in more accountability towards those that have been causing harm for so many years. And I think it's about remedying these wrongs, and it can be done. And that's what we're asking the ICJ. How do we do that? Essentially, we have this opportunity to shape international law to provide us that clarity, that guidance. Okay, there has been some breach of conduct. There's been a breach of international law in this. People have been suffering for so many years. How do we correct that? And I think that's a very important discussion to have in the climate change space, because a lot of these aspects relating to climate justice, things like the loss and damage fund, it took almost 30 years for it to materialize in whatever form it is right now. And sometimes gives the idea that aspects of climate justice, whatever's meant to give you climate justice, will take a long time. And they're not progressing as quickly as we need it to be within existing processes and mechanisms. And so This is an attempt to make sure we put climate justice at the center, that the ICJ's advisory opinion is not just a climate change advisory opinion, but it is a climate justice advisory opinion.
Sounds wonderful. I really hope that we actually get there eventually.
Absolutely.
I really hope so. Lastly, looking into the future, we're getting very close to the 22nd of March, as mentioned. Anything you would like to share with our audience?
The 22nd of March is a very important deadline for all of us. This is the first round of submissions, and we need countries to understand and really advance helpful submissions to the ICJ. One of the values we hold in this campaign is that we do not want to name and shame countries. By naming and shaming, we essentially will not get very far. All of us need to work together. And so the idea of shaming and naming countries will not get us there. We need everyone, and we say this often, that this is a journey the Pacific has embarked on for climate justice. The Pacific, we call it the Waka, which is a traditional Pacific canoe. It has been a great symbol of empowerment in the region, and the Pacific have been great voyages, the Pacific Islanders. And so this is another historic voyage the Pacific is taking to the ICJ for climate justice. And what we're looking at is all countries of the world really to jump on board our Waka, jump on board the canoe, and work with us on this. And so we're really trying to ensure that we involve as many people as possible, that this becomes an all hands on deck approach or all hands on deck campaign, and that regardless of whether you're a global South or a global North countries, we're facing a challenge that is bigger than all of us right now. We need submissions that help build, develop, and progress international law to be more robust, more capable of addressing the climate crisis. We're in a stage right now where we do not have the luxury of waiting many years for another advisory opinion or for another initiative or something else to come up. We need to take action now. Everything and everyone is telling us that we need to take action now. I think countries need to seize this opportunity and really show the way in this, because if we're able to get a strong opinion from the ICJ, this will have a generational impact. It will have a generational impact on the laws and the international legal space that is there. And we really need, and I talked about the intergenerational aspect of this whole campaign. This is also about trying to leave behind international law to be in a much better place than the one that we inherited when we were born. To leave behind for future generations a much more capable legal system, able to respond to the plight of people that are suffering, that are at the front lines, and broadly for all of us, because at one point or the other, we will all be facing the impacts of climate change. So the ICJ has this opportunity. Countries must rise up as well, because there is no time for finding loopholes. There is no more time at the ICJ for us to come up with unhelpful submissions. This is the opportunity, and we hope countries do take it. And that's the call from the young people.
Very unifying and very, very beautiful metaphor, actually. Thank you so much, Rochelle.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.